Good afternoon. We're slightly later than we should have been, but we will try and keep this session finishing at 5 o'clock, after which we will have drinks in the next door foyer for everyone. Everyone is invited. This session, session four and the last one of the symposium, is called Displaced Styles. The chair of this session is Linda Sandino, who is a senior research fellow, coordinator of the Voices in the Visual Arts VIVA project at Camberwell College of Arts. She graduated from the VNA RCA MA in 1991, specializing in the representation of crafts and the applied arts in the world and in word and image. As keeper of the Camberwell ILEA collection of design and craft, research and teaching has concentrated on this area, with a recent shift into oral history after completing extensive and intensive life histories recordings for the National Life Story Collection at the British Library National Sound Archive, interviewing artists, architects, craftspeople, and designers. Linda will chair the questions at the end of each paper. The first speaker of this session is Toshio Watanabe, and he is Director Designate of Research Center for Transnational Art, Identity and Nation, TRAIN. His publications include High Victorian Japanism. Yes? Toshio?
Yeah.
Published in 1991. He's the winner of the Prize of the Society for the Study of Japanism, Japan and Britain, An Aesthetic Dialogue, 1850-1930, and Ruskin in Japan, 1890-1940. Nature for Art, Art for Life, in 1997. Currently principal investigator of the three-year TRAIN research project, Forgotten Japanism, The Taste for Japanese Art and Britain in the USA, 1920s to 1950s, funded by the HRC. The second paper that was previously scheduled for the afternoon was replaced by Fernando Cocchiarale's Art and Politics at the Margin of Multiculturalism. As Fernando is not here, Michael Asbury will read the paper, and he won't answer questions, but will open the discussion on this subject during the session, the discussion at the end. And the third paper of this afternoon session is by Paolo Venanzio Filho, who is a professor of the Rio de Janeiro Federal University, an independent curator and art critic, and was the curator of the exhibition Rio de Janeiro 1950-1964 at Century City, which took place at Tate Modern in 2001. Recent exhibitions include Anna Maria Maiolino at the Pinacoteca do Estado de São Paulo in 2006 and Antonio Manuel at the Centro Cultural Banco do Brasil this year. And I would like to introduce Toshio Watanabe now. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Now something completely different. No Brazil. Okay. This paper will examine the vicissitude of transnational understanding by investigating how mid-19th century Hamburg variously valued Englishness. We will explore first the identity of Hamburg, so-called the most English German city, then English architects and engineers in Hamburg during the 1840s, and finally, the Hamburg Town Hall, the 1854 competition, and the furious debate on how it should look like and who should build it. Hamburg, during medieval times, was part of the Hanseatic League with other cities, such as Bremen and Lübeck, and since then has fiercely maintained its independence as a free city-state. Even during the period under discussion, the city was an autonomous state within the German Confederation from 1815 and then within the German Empire after 1870. At times, Hamburg politicians had to compromise in order to survive, such as during the period of the Napoleonic Wars or when under pressure from Bismarck. However, these compromises were made very reluctantly, whether with foreigners or with other German powers. Politically, Hamburg's identity as an independent and free city-state was more important to it than any concept of German nationhood. The notion of Germany as a nation is debatable anyway for this period, but even if we accept this, Hamburg was perhaps the most reluctant and aloof member of it. Mercantile principles were also more important than German nationalism. Thus, a certain distance from German issues and a highly pragmatic attitude to politics were significant characteristics of Hamburg. At the same time, Hamburg was often referred to as the most English German city. The city's relationship with England was long-standing and complex. Richard J. Evans mentions in his seminal book on the history of 19th century Hamburg that in the 1830s, half the city's seaborne trade was carried in English ships, and many of the leading Hamburg firms had branches in London. However, more importantly, within our context, Evans points out that the great merchant families cultivated a self-consciously English style of life, employed English nannies, bought English clothes, and frequently gave their children English names such as Percy, Henry, John, or William. Another important point he makes is that the gradual reforms, the element of continuity, and the principle of property-owning parliamentary system, albeit one with its own very distinctive features, all helped to single Hamburg out as an English city. Now, let us examine the situation in Hamburg during the 1840s. On 5th of May, 1842, disaster struck Hamburg. A huge fire raged for 4 days and made 20,000 people homeless. Nearly one-third of the city was flattened. A major rebuilding program was needed, and this was entrusted to an English engineer, William Lindley. There he is. The choice of Lindley was obvious enough. Since 1838, he had been engaged in building the railway from Hamburg to Bergedorf and was therefore at hand for the reconstruction of the city. When Lindley received railway commission, he was only 30 years old, but had references from Robert Stephenson and Isambard Brunel, and was a protege and assistant of a leading British engineer, Francis Giles. Indeed, at this time, British urban engineering was unrivaled and much in demand on the continent. On 12th of May, just a few days after the fire was put out, the authorities asked Lindley for advice. The speed of his response was astonishing. He submitted a plan for the rebuilding of the part of Hamburg which was destroyed by fire within the same day. He had already privately been forging a plan for Hamburg's urban improvements, especially in the area of urban hygiene. The fire gave him a golden opportunity to put this into practice. He got the job and successfully completed it. Thanks to him, Hamburg became the first city with a modern water supply and sewage system on the continent. Lindley became an important and influential personality within Hamburg architectural circles as well. The next large project in the rebuilding of Hamburg was that of the Nikolaikirche. This was no ordinary church and was regarded by the citizens as one of the symbols of the city. It has been pointed out that for the German Gothic revival, this project was second only in importance to that of Cologne Cathedral, how it looked like then, that the Cologne Cathedral. The original Nikolaikirche was ruined by the 1842 fire, and an international competition for a new building was announced in 1844. 38 entries were received in time and 6 after the deadline. Among the late entries was one by George Gilbert Scott, delayed by the winter ice. In February 1845, The jury decided in favor of the Rundbogenstil design, the round arch style submitted by Gottfried Semper, you see on the screen, whereas Scott, with his Gothic Revival design, received only third prize. However, objections to the choice of Semper were voiced, and two outside experts, Sulpitz Boisseret and Ernst Zwirner, both Gothicists, were called in to judge the entries. Boisseret could not come to Hamburg because of illness, but submitted a written report in favor of the Gothic style, and Zwirner chose Scott's design. Scott received the commission. That's his design. And the church was successfully completed with some modifications to the original plans after Scott's death. A great deal of heated debate went on publicly and behind the scenes. There was a complicated web of personal connections and interests involved, but on the whole, there were two polarized camps. Rundbogenstil Semper on the one hand, and Gothic Revival Scott on the other. The issue of nationality crops up frequently in the discussions. Another old photo of the same church. The Semper camp's objections to Scott's plan are mostly reasonable, such as missing the competition deadline, vague estimates of the cost, shortage of seating, blocking the view of the preacher with pillars, etc. However, then, the argument is extended to say that Gothic style per se is unsuitable for Protestant churches. He also claimed that the development of the Romanesque as a truly national style was disrupted by the introduction of the pointed arch. Semper contradicted himself later by submitting an alternative plan in the very Gothic style he had criticized. The Scott camp's argument was much more emotionally loaded and brings in the issue of nationalism more openly. Scott, in fact, traveled to Germany to study German Gothic specifically in preparation for this project. In an explanatory report, he actually apologizes for submitting as a foreigner, but emphasizes that he intended to sing the praise of the typically German Gothic style. He states here that German Gothic is the best of them all, though shortly afterwards, in 1847, when he experienced French Gothic firsthand, he did change his mind. Here's Mr. Scott. Thus, Scott was not presenting his